What we're going to do is we're going to have a look at this whole issue of communion. Here's the table. We're going to be sharing communion. And everybody's welcome at this table. Absolutely everybody. You may have experienced in the past, and indeed you may have experienced here, that we'll ask folks, you know, if you love the Lord, you come to the table. Today I think there's grace for everybody to come, regardless of where you are in terms of your life journey. And I want to share with you a bit about this table. For this table belongs to Jesus. It's His table. He's the one who invites us. And last week we were looking at the whole issue of the community, that God makes community. He made us for community. Our God is a community in three in one, as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And this table is an expression of His love for us, and He invites us. It's His invitation to us all to come share this meal. So last week we were looking at this wonderful truth that it's Jesus who invites us to His table. Now, I said that I was going to be talking about this fellow, John Calvin. John Calvin was a theologian and French church leader who in Geneva in Switzerland modeled the way that we do church now. Not everything. You'll have noticed I don't have his snappy dress sense, and I can only aspire to his facial topiary. But John Calvin's way of understanding what it was to gather around this table still influences us to this day and our understanding of how we do church, how we are bound to God's Word. I was being reminded that I know that many of you come from a Catholic background, and there were many reformations in the Catholic Church, not least the arrival of the Franciscans and Dominicans in the 1300s. But those groups managed to reform from within. In some ways, unfortunately, during the Reformation time, Calvin and Luther had to reform from without. Sometimes it goes that way. But his understanding of what this is here and what we did at baptism was a thing called a sacrament. Now, the church had talked about sacraments for years, tried to understand what they were. And Calvin has this wonderful phrase that he uses that, if I remember rightly, he gets from elsewhere, that the sacrament is a visible sign of an invisible grace. So you can see the bread and wine here. You'll be able to see the elders as they serve you. You can see the musicians as they lead us in worship. You can see the love that 50 squillion young people have for Guy and Kate. You can see all of that. But the invisible grace that's behind it, the reason that we're here, God Himself is invisible to us. And we only see Him through the actions and attitudes, through the work that goes on in the people around about. So if you ever meet God for yourself, it is most likely to be done through other people. Now, this of course also is a very visible sign in that it's a meal. I apologize, it's not that filling. But historically it would have been. They would have gathered around a whole meal, and we'll talk a bit more about that in a bit. But what I want to do today is to run you through 10 meals. Did anyone miss breakfast? This might hurt. So find someone else on your pew who's brought some food with them. Again, the endless handbag might come in helpful. We're going to look at 10 meals, each of them quite briefly. Some of them will be familiar to you. I've missed out some that you'll be able to. It's not an exhaustive list. But these are meals of which Jesus plays a part. Number one, a wedding. Who likes a good wedding? Who doesn't like a good wedding? Come on, be honest. Yes, that's good. Andy's the only honest one here. A good wedding, a big party that's had at that time where people commit to one another. And a good wedding shebang can be a great shebang. And Andy's got a point, a bad one can be very, very, very long. As a minister once said to me when he was asked if he went to the reception, he said, "How long am I going to have to wait to get a meal?" It can be a long, drawn-out affair. But this was not. This was going to be a good wedding. And Jesus had been invited. We read about it in John chapter 2. So here we are. The next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother told him, "They have no more wine." The conversation goes on. "Lady, it's not my time." but it was Jesus' mom. So what did Jesus do on this occasion? Jesus brings the wine. Do you know anybody who really knows their wine well? Frankly, I'm a bit of a Luddite when it comes to wine. But I'm told, if you know your stuff, and you've got a certain dish, you'll pick the right wine to go with it. In posh restaurants that I can't afford the starter at, they'll tell you which wine goes with which course. Or so I'm told. Jesus brings the wine, the best wine they've ever tasted. And that's weird, because Uncle Harry's already a bit tipsy. Or it'll be Uncle Jacob, because it was a Jewish wedding. And you'd usually have the best wine first, and then you get down to the blue nun later on. Except they wouldn't be blue nun, because they were Jewish again. So, you know, be Lionel blue, or something like that. That's what Jesus does in meal number one. He brings the wine. Good? Oh yeah. Absolutely. Of course, had he done that at a Scottish wedding, they'd have got billed for the corkage. But that's another thing. Then I want to go to another meal. And this is, the first tax collector. Matthew. Matthew was one of Jesus' followers, the first of the Gospels in the New Testament's named after him. He was a Jewish lad who was working for the occupying forces. Not very popular with his neighbors. His friendship group included some interesting people. Let's have a look. Later, Matthew invited Jesus and his disciples to come home as a dinner guest, and along with many tax collectors and other disreputable sinners. I apologize if you work for the HMRC. I, too, worked for the Inland Revenue back in the day. But, of course, tax collectors in these days, really, they got the money for the Romans and then they embezzled everything else. Their take-home pay was what else they could extract from you. And they lived quite well, except that everybody hated them, apart from other tax collectors and people who struggled to keep decent company. So where was Jesus found? He was found in a disrespectable person's house. And did he go? Yes, he did. Kind of strange, isn't it, that much of the church experience I had when I was a child was very much about decorum. People wanted to be seen to be doing the right thing, and I can understand that. But Jesus actually wasn't that bothered. He didn't mind that people watched him going into Matthew's house along with the other tax collectors. And he went there with his disciples too. And Matthew joined that group. He left his ill-gotten gains, as it were. He left his wealthy lifestyle. He left his position with the occupying forces. And off he went to follow Jesus. Jesus brings friendship. He brings friendship. One of the most extraordinary things I've seen in recent years is a missionary in Thailand sitting down and having a Coke with an individual who I think they call them ladyboys, who's a prostitute. Nobody had the time of day for this guy, except they wanted his services. I'm watching this missionary share the love of Jesus with this person and give them dignity and respect and love and the hope of a better life than the life that they had. And this was in the context of a city where the first source of income is the sex trade. And Jesus brings friendship. Jesus also went to another tax collector's home. This guy was called Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was also very good at his job, so was despised. However, and this wasn't his fault, he was short. And so you'll know the story perhaps of Zacchaeus, maybe colored in a book when you were a kid. No one was going to let Zacchaeus to the front to see, because they despised him. So the poor wee short stuff had to climb up a tree to see Jesus. Which was brave enough, because if I'd been part of the crowd and seen a tax collector up the tree, I think we maybe could have made it rock a bit. It's a vulnerable place to be. Jesus stops in Jericho, looks up, sees Zacchaeus, and then does this. And Jesus came by, looked up at Zacchaeus, and called him by name. Are you kidding? Do you think he had a t-shirt on that said, "My name's Zacchaeus"? Picks this guy out in the crowd and says, "Zacchaeus, quick, come down. I must be a guest in your home today. Jesus invited himself. And if you know the story, you know that Jesus goes in, and you can just imagine those people with the social duty of tutting, would have been tutting and wringing their hands, and you know, it would have made it round. Something disreputable had happened. For example, when our young people were leading worship, what would it be? 2 years ago, in September, they started off worship with a toilet roll fight. And faster than you could drive to Newton Grange, someone knew that that had happened here. And heads were being hung. For that's not what you do in church. And so people were looking at Zacchaeus' house and thinking, what's Jesus doing in there? Thought this person was supposed to be someone. They were supposed to be good, supposed to be a godly person, a teacher. We don't know what happens at the meal other than Jesus eats with him. But Zacchaeus comes out after that meal. I'd love to see the video, DVD, podcast, stream, whatever you have to watch. I'd love to see it. Because Zacchaeus walks out of that house and says, I'm going to give half my money away to the poor. And if I've embezzled anyone, they're going to get four times back. Jesus brings transformation. At this meal, Jesus brought transformation. He sat down with the most disliked person in town and turned him into Bill Gates. Wealthy but kind. Then we've got some Simons. The first Simon, this is one of my favorites. By the way, does anybody here think the Gospels are all made up stories? Okay, you concentrating? What's a really hard thing to get when you're telling a story about a place? It's really hard to get the names right, right? Yeah? I mean, how many Ryans and Kierans are there in Gore Bridge? It's not County Clare. It's not, you know. We're not over the Irish Sea. The number of boys who've got Irish names in this town is extraordinary. You'll know some of them, and maybe you chose the names because you liked them. I don't know, maybe it was to do with an Irish boy band. I have no idea. There's just lots of them about. But if you went a couple of towns away, it might be different names. It might be different names. A German lady, Germans are good at this sort of thing, looked through all the death records and bone boxes, because that's where you went, because nobody's buried for long. They were put in a tomb until all the soft stuff went away, and then the remains were put in a bone box, looked at the names of that. Names and records, that she went through and listed all the names for Judea and Galilee. Do you know what the top name was for the whole of Judea and Galilee? Simon. Top name. If you just went a few dozen miles south to Alexandria in Egypt, where there was a huge Jewish population, Simon, I don't think, was even in the top 10. Isn't that amazing? And that's why there's Simon the Pharisee, or Simon who's now Peter, or Simon of Cyrene. They have to pick out which Simons. There's astonishing evidence that the stories that we have are not only about the place, but from the time, because over time it changes too. Because if their information was made up, you know, maybe the Gospels would have had Kylie and Jason, or whatever other names become popular. It's a fascinating bit of evidence of how early the Gospel stories are. And the first Simon we're with is Simon Peter. Now, Simon's mother-in-law was sick in bed with a high fever. And they told Jesus about her right away. And what does Jesus do? Bring her grapes. He heals her. What does she do once she's healed? She waits on them. How cool is that? Jesus, my mother-in-law, she's not doing so well. See that thing you do with sick people? No problem. Up you get. Lasagna, please. At this meal, he brings healing. Well, he kind of brings healing, then he gets a meal. What about the second Simon? This isn't Simon Peter, who was one of Jesus' followers. This guy is Simon the Pharisee. A certain immoral woman from that city heard Jesus was eating there. He'd been invited by Simon the Pharisee, wanted to check Jesus out. She brought a beautiful alabaster bar filled with expensive perfume. Then she knelt behind him at his feet, weeping, her tears falling on his feet, and she wiped them off with her hair, and she kept kissing them and putting perfume on them. So Jesus is in the house of Simon the Pharisee. Simon is a man of standing. He knows his scriptures. He worships God. Some estimates he would be giving away 37% of his income to good causes if he was following the law. But he's suspicious of Jesus, and he's brought him to dinner to figure him out, suss him out. You know, like us parents do when people start dating. Okay, you're coming around for tea? It's amazing that those of us who are parents of daughters, maybe I'm alone in this, but I really want to invite the lad round to see if I'm going to have to break his legs early or break his legs later. It's funny that, isn't it? Maybe it's just me. Anyway, this woman brings this perfume. This perfume was probably an heirloom, something that was passed from generation to generation because it was phenomenally valuable. And it's in a sealed jar. She has to break it open. It's not, you know, it's not like she could go down to perfume direct or whatever and get some more. This was it. And she's thinking, how can I say thank you to Jesus for what he's brought into my life? Because those who've been forgiven much love much, as Jesus said. It's not the well people who need a doctor. And she's busy figuring out a way to love him, and she's maybe thinking she'd anoint him with a perfume, but then she's in floods of tears, and that's washing his feet, and that's symbolic of the lowliest job of the lowliest servant in the house. Jesus' feet is getting washed, and he's not getting washed with a mop and bucket and a servant. It's getting washed by tears and perfume. And we know from this story that Simon the Pharisee looks at him and thinks, hey, if he knew who was doing this, he would know that this is not good. And Jesus, discerning what Simon was thinking, says, do you know what? I came here, you didn't wash my feet. You haven't welcomed me. In other words, you're busy here testing me. This woman, she's amazing. And yet she was a prostitute. Jesus brings grace. Grace is the toughest to explain stuff, but the most wonderful to experience. Because in grace, what God does is he takes our broken, sinful, wicked-oriented stuff, and he says, don't worry, I'll deal with that. Trust in me, and it'll be fine. And we think, well, it can't be fine. There must be some problem somewhere, and there is, but we don't get to suffer it, as we'll see in a bit. Jesus brings grace. So then we go to the Passover. Now we're going back 1,500 years before Jesus is born. His forefathers, the Jews, are in captivity. Abram's family has ended up in slavery in Egypt. And anybody who knows about Joseph's Technicolor Dreamcoat will know the story of how that happened. And so God has sent this guy Moses to rescue his people. And he sent him. He's 80-year-old. He's got a stick that turns into a snake and a stutter. Not very promising. And there he goes to Pharaoh and say, can I have your entire service sector, please? Would you give me it? Because God says, let them go. And he doesn't. And plague after plague hits Egypt, and then there's the Passover. While the Israelites were still in the land of Egypt, we read in Exodus 12, the Lord gave the following instructions to Moses and Aaron. From now on, this month will be the first of the year for you. Announce to the whole community of Israel, on this 10th day of this month, each family must choose a lamb or a young goat as a sacrifice, one animal for each household. Because God had given them these instructions, and those that had followed it, Jews and Egyptians alike, were saved. And in that extraordinary image of what Jesus is about to do, the blood from the sacrificed lamb that was going to be eaten was to be painted on the wooden doorposts of the house. The Passover meal. Jesus brings rescue. Say, hang on a minute, Jesus wasn't born yet. This is 1,500 years before he was there. We're going to be explaining that in a minute. But Jesus brings rescue. Rescue to people who are oppressed. Rescue to those who are in prison, in slavery. Those who are in actual bondage, and those who are in bondage to all that stuff that ties us up. Jesus brings rescue. Because the Passover becomes the Last Supper. As Jesus is sitting round with his friends, they're having a Passover meal. From Matthew 26, as they were eating, Jesus took the bread and he blessed it and gave it to the disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body." He goes on to take the cup to say, "This is my blood." They're at a Passover meal. There's bread, there's wine, and there's lamb cooked in bitter herbs. Bread, wine, lamb cooked in bitter herbs. It's a kebab. That's what Jesus had inherited from his forefathers. And you put it like that and you think, that's not a hard sell, is it? We're going to do our religious observance with wine and kebab. You up for that? Of course, in Scotland, what happens is you drink the wine and then you go, I fancy a kebab. And then you overshoot and the seagulls get the leftovers. Oh, we are a mucky people. Anyway, so here's the Passover meal. It's been handed on from generation to generation. The bread, the wine, the lamb, everybody knew it. Bread, wine, lamb. Bread, wine, lamb. If you went to an Orthodox Jewish household, even a Reformed Jewish household, it would be the same today. Bread and wine and lamb. And yet Jesus takes this stuff and he just gives them bread and wine. Why does he do that? Did they run out of lamb? Who's the lamb in the Last Supper? Who's the lamb at the Last Supper? Who's the one that John said, "You are the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world"? The lamb at the Last Supper is Jesus himself. You see, as Jesus takes the Passover, it becomes the Last Supper. As we read through, Jesus gives himself. He's saying, all these years you've been celebrating the Passover and you've seen the lamb and the bread and the wine as separate. But what I'm telling you is the bread and wine are symbolic of the body broken and the bloodshed of that lamb, which is symbolic of the lamb that will be slain, which is me, because that's how I can bring rescue and grace and healing. That's how I can bring these things to you. And that's why Paul's going to write about 20 years after Jesus sat down with his disciples at the Last Supper and speak of Christ our Passover, the one who gives himself for us so that the death and destruction that's coming to us passes us by. Meal number 8, the meal at Emmaus. I'm very fond of this meal. This is after the resurrection, except not everybody knows about it. Jesus is showing up as a pristine zombie because he doesn't look like he's been in the grave. In fact, he's kind of shiny now. He's sort of recognizable, but not recognizable. We don't quite know why the two people on the road to Emmaus, perhaps husband and wife, are making their way down. But he's hidden from their sight, whether, I don't know, maybe God makes them thick. That happens at times. Or perhaps it's that Jesus has a hoodie top on and he's just keeping it up. Whatever it is, they don't recognize him. Until they invite him to stay for a meal, and this happens. As they sat down to eat, he took bread and blessed it. And then he broke it and gave it to them. And suddenly their eyes were opened and they recognized him. Why? Because they'd seen him do it before. They'd heard about this. And all of their disillusion and pain and sorrow at what had happened at the crucifixion is turned to hope because they met with Jesus, risen from the dead, eating food, non-apparition. Not the product of magic mushrooms. I wish I could tell you that was a made-up story, but the book has been written. Indeed, as I often say, if your pension pot is looking a bit light, write a zany book about how Jesus was made up. You'll sell a million. If not just to Christians who want to read while you're up the creek. Number 9, breakfast on the beach. We've actually done this here. We barbecued the fish in the corner. We filled the church with the smoke and steam of the Lord's presence. I won't explain why. We made a beach up at the front on old canvas. We poured in the sand and people were playing on the beach. Here's the story. At dawn, Jesus was standing on the beach. The disciples couldn't see who he was. And he called out, "Hey, guys, you caught any fish?" To which the answer was, no, not a sausage. Not that you can catch sausages. Maybe in the West you could catch a sausage. And then Simon Peter recognizes it's Jesus. He's out the boat, he's swimming to the shore because he's so delighted to see it. Jesus is cooking up a fish breakfast, sorry if you're a vegetarian. And they sit round on the fire and they share, but there's a problem between them because Peter has denied Jesus. He said he wouldn't and he's done it. What does Jesus do? He forgives him. Jesus brings forgiveness. And Simon Peter's restored. And just as his mother-in-law was restored to health, so he's restored to friendship and fellowship with Jesus, having let him down sorely, having said that he wouldn't. A meal number 10. The party at the end of time. Sounds like a Douglas Adams line, I know. But the scriptures speak of something that hasn't happened yet. We've been speaking about things in the past, 1,500, 1,000 years, 2,000 years ago, 3,500 and 2,000 years ago. But there's a party at the end of time that's spoken of in the book of Revelation. It says this, and the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb. And he added, these are true words that come from God. That John who wrote down the account of Jesus sitting at the beach cooking fish, it was probably Jesus' best friend. Now, we don't know if John wrote everything about it, but from very, very, very early on, these words were associated with John. John was a remarkable guy. He was imprisoned for his faith on the Isle of Patmos. And while he was there, instead of being all glum about being in chains, God in his mercy turned that prison into a vision of heaven. And he writes those words down in Revelation. He sends it off as a letter to the church in Ephesus and the other churches in the area that he had concern for. And then in all likelihood, he's restored to them. And in that vision is this thing, that at the end of time, you and I are invited to a meal, which this symbolizes. So from the Passover that the Jews practiced, through to the Last Supper that Jesus passed on to us, through all of the church practice through the years down to today, here in 2015, and on to that point at the marriage feast of the Lamb, when those who trust God and those who trust God and Jesus are brought together as a man and woman are brought together in marriage, a bond that close, that inseparable, a party that good, Andrew, it will be. That's going to be a good wedding. And those who trust in God are invited. Jesus brings recreation. Because actually this world is not as it should be. And it's only through Jesus it gets remade. And his resurrection from the dead is the start of that process. His work in us is the start of that process. Look, sometimes people will say to me, you know, what's God really like? If there really is a God. If you're not just the leader of a creepy cult and that stuff's all up the creek. What's God like? Jesus said this, anyone who's seen me has seen the Father. In other words, as I keep saying, you can't get a rizzle of paper between Jesus and God the Father. If you understand Jesus' character, Jesus would say you understand God's character. That's why Jesus, in all likelihood, in Pascal's old thingy, was either mad, bad, or God. He was either mad because he was deluded and should have been on medication. He was bad because he was deceiving people intentionally. Or he actually was who he claimed he was. The Son of God come among us. So if we see God in Jesus, if Jesus, as Paul's going to write, is the exact representation of God, what's he like? Well, we see in these 10 meals, Jesus brings friendship. He brings transformation. He brings healing. He brings rescue. Jesus brings grace and hope and forgiveness. Jesus brings recreation. And at this table in particular, we remember that Jesus brings the wine and Jesus gives himself. Jesus' work in Guy and Kate's life is something you can see. It's a visible sign of an invisible grace. Those changes you've seen, those, I'm amazed at that pair, at how they give, along with so many of our other young people and many of our older people too. The way they commit, the way they spend time and love some of the wildest kids in Gore Bridge. And friends, that means some of the wildest kids in the UK. It certainly does. The service that David and David and Anne and Brenda have given, the way that they've helped sort things out, be it the finances or the hall lets, be it the session meetings, be it our work at Presbytery, be it that church officer role of making sure that the place is warm and open and everything's as it should be and there's water in the font. That's a visible sign of an invisible grace. Jesus is a visible sign of an invisible grace. He is that grace, that free giving of God on our behalf. Remember, friends, Jesus brings the wine. Jesus gives himself. So let's share in that. One last word. I've been praying about today, and I know the other elders have too. And my sense is that as you take this bread and wine, God is going to do something for you. I don't know what. I don't know how. Well, I kind of do know how. It's by His Spirit. It doesn't matter if you're an atheist or an agnostic. If you're dead enthusiastic or you're lapsed. If you came here because you felt it was your duty to do so, or you came here because you couldn't do anything else and the joy was spilling over. And that bread and wine is something for everybody here. Because Jesus said, we gather to receive from Him. Take, eat, this is my body. Take, drink, this is my blood shed for you. And that's not just some spiritual notion. This is a real visible sign of an invisible grace from the God who loves you, and that same Jesus who had a habit of showing up at people's houses, having a good time, and leaving a big difference.